CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batzer. To Australia with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, and my Australian guide on the very large success of these last years in defending our allies in the Indo-Pacific from the aggression, the predation, the threat of the People's Republic of China. I'm speaking of AUKUS, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., conjoined in a fashion that requires articulation. And Gregory Copley's here, Defense and Foreign Affairs, to help me. The significance of Richard Marles, the new defense minister, saying that they're near to completing the plans for nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS pact in the Indo-Pacific. This has been a debate for some time. Is it going to be U.S. technology, U.K. technology? Is it going to be a submarine lent to Australia out of Perth, out of the naval base near Perth? Is there going to be an upset in Australia because of the no-nuke faction? All of these questions are in abeyance. At the same time, there are the French. Gregory, do I say that this is news for the better? Richard Marles says the government is almost ready.
That's correct. I mean, in fact, he telegraphed this, saying that there'd be soon be an announcement of importance. In fact, I understand that's going to come in March, and it's going to be a joint statement by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, President Biden, and the Australian Prime Minister to announce where this is going. And it looks like the Labor government is now going to commit about $100 billion, that's about 71 billion US dollars, to the acquisition of nuclear submarines. These will have to be U.S. submarines, and almost certainly would be Virginia class, possibly initially acquiring a couple of Virginia class nuclear submarines from the U.S. Navy as the U.S. Navy takes delivery of its newer Virginia class vessels, and while the Australian government builds its own nuclear submarine construction capability. That is not likely to yield an Australian-built nuclear submarine for at least 18 years. So the sale or lease of U.S. Virginia-class submarines is going to be critical. The British Astute class, which was really interesting for the Royal Australian Navy and started the move by the Royal Australian Navy to nuclear boats, is not going to be as efficient for this job as the Virginia class. Now, the question is whether the Australian government has yet tackled the issue of changing legislation to define who controls these nuclear reactors. In the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Navy controls the reactors even when they come ashore for refueling or replacement from the vessels, whether they're carriers or submarines and the like. Not that they get replaced in the submarines, but the reality is that the civilian authorities do not control the U.S. nuclear reactors from the vessels when they come ashore. In Britain, the civilian component of the government takes control of the reactors when the ships come in for full refits and the reactors have to come out or are serviced. And that's caused enormous delays and inefficiencies. So Australia's going to have to sort out that legislation, and I think they will. They'll probably, as I say, lease two Virginia-class vessels, maybe one at a time. They'll just learn it. The Royal Australian Navy already has a significant number of officers and ratings training in the United States Navy on board Virginia-class submarines, and they also have a significant number of officers and ratings training aboard the Astute-class submarines in the United Kingdom. Again, there's going to have to be some new legislation to determine how these officers and how you man the vessels, because in the U.S. Navy, nuclear crew are all nuclear crew, and whereas in the Royal Navy, you've got what are called deck officers or seamen officers who are not necessarily nuclear trained or nuclear specialists. But so the Australians are going to have to either change their approach and get a nuclear Navy component, or learn from the Brits how to manage the the marriage, if you like, of seaman officers and nuclear specialists. So all of these are very interesting. But the short term is Australia will get nuclear vessels. They'll lease them or buy them from the US, the second hand, and then start with the building their own program, which will profoundly change the Australian approach to nuclear power, because it will create a nuclear power industry in Australia. The long-term impact of this post-China, in other words, after we see the collapse of the People's Republic of China as the major threat, will be to balance against the Indian nuclear and sea power presence in the Indian Ocean. Australia is the stalwart, if you like, in working with India as a fellow Commonwealth country, but literally they are competitive powers. Yes, Australia and India are friendly and will cooperate, as Australia will with Indonesia and as Indonesia does with India, but really they're all competitive. And Australia will need to offset the growing expansionism of India, even though India itself is a growing strategic power, faces many, many other problems as well.
Gregory, why? My impression was that Beijing was rattled at this news. Why? What does it mean for Beijing's aggression?
Well, Australia is increasingly capable of projecting power up beyond the ASEAN waterways of Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on, and Papua New Guinea. The nuclear boats give them a longer duration presence, which is threatening to the People's Liberation Army Navy. Not just the submarines, of course. Australia has a heavy surface warfare capability, including two flat tops, which can take Australian armor and army personnel up into battle zones in Southeast Asia and Asia. And also they can project air power. And the Australian Air Force is getting longer legs so that it can launch theater strategic hypersonic weapons against PRC or PLA targets in the future. So Australia is a significant factor in that region and has the ability to blunt the PLA offensives down into the South Pacific and Southeast Asia. Australia obviously works in alliance with the UK and the US on this. So China is definitely trying to push back against any expansion of AUKUS capability, Australia, UK, US alliance capability in the region, which is why they were pushing to get Argentina to threaten to invade the Falklands again, just so that the British would be forced to put their carrier battle groups in the South Atlantic rather than the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
The Defense Minister Marles and the Foreign Minister Penny Wong from Australia traveling to Europe to meet with the UK, that's sensible. Meet with the French as well. My memory is the French were profoundly upset when Australia moved from French submarines to American and UK submarines. Has that been patched up?
It's been patched up to a large degree. And in fact, the French just had a major conference on submarine warfare, which they held in Tahiti. Very significant. And they had, I think, one nuclear attack boat of theirs there. And they invited the Australians. The talk was that they said, well, okay, we understand that the old submarine program is dead. They've given up on selling nuclear boats to Australia. Now they're saying, well, maybe we can come up with an interim conventional boat so that there's no submarine gap when the present Australian fleet of six Collins-class submarines are retired. There's likely to be a submarine gap unless something is done, and the two or so Virginia-class vessels will help that. But the French are really talking about, well, we can sell you some Scorpion conventional submarines as part of the stopgap situation to give you the capability in the region. Now, the Scorpion is already being built in India for the Indian Navy and in Pakistan. So the Scorpion wouldn't give the Australians the one thing which they profoundly require, which is the ability to overmatch any regional power. And that was what was so good about the Collins-class submarine, which was a Swedish design, but working with the United States became really the most, one of the most advanced conventional submarines of its age in Australia. That nobody was able to touch that in the region, and Australia wants that that sort of overmatch to continue.
A U.S. general, an Air Force general, in these last days, according to the Wall Street Journal editorial page, has made a remark, I believe in a written document, but somehow it made its way into the press. The expectation is of war with the People's Republic over Taiwan by 2025. Earlier, there were remarks from Navy officials, 2027. Do you account for this, Gregory? And is it too early for Australia to defend itself if there is a conflict in Taiwan?
It's not too early, and it may be too late for the People's Republic of China itself to mount such a war. It would definitely be a war of desperation, which would arise because Xi Jinping could see that absent some major factor like a war, he would be thrown out of office. And that could happen in the next few years, given the decline of the PRC economy, the dissatisfaction with him by the PLA and other Communist Party officials. The whole Communist Party itself could collapse. And Xi could undertake what Leopoldo Galtieri did in Argentina in 1982, which was to mount a last-minute war against the Falklands so that he would be seen as a hero and stay in office. And Xi would may use that logic to launch an attack on Taiwan. But the very crude war gaming, which the Center for Strategic and International Studies did in Washington recently on wargaming an attack on Taiwan, it showed that the PLA would be defeated in that activity. And even though the US and Japan and Australia could lose lots of assets, nonetheless, Beijing could not win that war. So, look, a brief. The senior U.S. Air Force officers around the country regularly, and have been doing so for many years, and have been trying to convince them that what we're seeing, yes, is a short-term tactical capability by the People's Liberation Army, which is really impressive, but the strategic backing for that by the government and Communist Party of China is not as solid as it should be, because let's face it, if they attack Taiwan, the U.S. will immediately cut off the food sales to the People's Republic of China, and they are importing so much U.S. food that if we cut off the food supply to China, they will starve within weeks. So there are many factors constraining Beijing from attacking Taiwan. Nonetheless, of course, you need this massive improvement in Taiwanese defenses just to deter any amateurish thinking by Xi Jinping, and he is an amateur, in wanting to attack Taiwan. Look, the U.S. is continuing to bolster Taiwan very discreetly. All those several hundred M1A1 Abrams tanks, which the Marine Corps has given up, most of those will be going to Taiwan. So there are all kinds of things going on all the time to see this constant improvement in Taiwanese defense capabilities. Yes, the PRC has a lot of options. They wouldn't do an amphibious operation across the Taiwan Straits because that would be comprehensively degraded before it got to Taiwan. They would do massive parrot dropping, and in fact, there's been discussion of them talking about using their new C-17-like heavy transport aircraft to drop as many as 200,000 paratroops on Taiwan. So that's an approach which would need defending against. But the reality is it would be a very, very hard slog for the PLA to successfully take over Taiwan. And if it was anything, it would be an act of desperation by an imploding Communist Party of China and a failed Xi Jinping administration. Not that they wouldn't try it, but it would not succeed and would certainly bring a lot of grief to everybody in the region.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. The King Charles Report coming up, my favorite moment of the week. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.